Hello and welcome to Unfrozen, episode 90, first of the 2025 season. We're kicking things off with a pre-inauguration special. Welcome to Megalopolis, inspired by the New York Review of Architecture's Roundup. And we have two of their writers joining us today for that one. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik. And yes, we are very happy to have aboard here Kate Wagner, who is, of course, the creator of McMansion Hell. And we've had her on the show before to much acclaim. And she's the design critic, architecture critic for The Nation. And we have Zach Mortis, who is also a design critic, sometimes for Bloomberg City Lab, and has been involved in the AIA here in Chicago for many years. So we are so pleased to have you here as we come across the dawn of what we're calling Megalopolis. What will be the impact of Trump 2.0 on the design world, on architecture, on cities? And I don't know, how do we even start to answer that question? I've seen a few speculations about, well, there's a couple different venues, I guess, that we could explore, right? So there's the federal architecture declaration that, of course, everything has to be classical, which got killed, you know, mercifully by the Biden administration as soon as they came in. And that doesn't, I haven't heard a lot about that since. But then we also have the issue of, okay, we're going to be theoretically constructing a lot of detention facilities and perhaps other infrastructure associated with expulsion of migrants. So is that the track we want to follow?
I want to start with that. I want to start with that with the two of you. Given that we know that President Trump has vowed to sign 100 executive orders on Inauguration Day with Stephen Miller lurking over his shoulder. Last time around with Trump, there was a whole debate about would architects participate in building the wall. Now we're at a whole new level. And so my first question for the two of you is, given what we did see, and Kate, you brought this up in The Nation with the activism around the architecture lobby and the others, will we see, given that we've seen this sort of cultural capitulation to the return, inevitable return of Trump, will we see any debate about building detention centers? And who, if you want to be really hot take about this, who's going to be the first to step up and say, we're building the President Trump Memorial Detention Camp on the U.S.-Mexico border in Texas? Kate, I'll throw it to you first, if you're willing to take it.
Yeah, I definitely think that, I hope that there's a resurgence in more kind of left-wing social justice-oriented architecture discourse again once Trump hits office. I'm really concerned that there's going to just be a kind of resignation, like, across the entire field. It's like, we tried that and it didn't work, and it's like, okay, well, we have to do it again, so, you know. But anyways, I kind of, as far as, like, the who question, I think really what we see in Gaza, for example, is a kind, or, like, in Saudi Arabia, this is really kind of, to me, the first step in what's going to come and do the kind of imperial boomerang back here in the U.S. So if I had to pick a firm, I would probably say it would be AECOM, who would be doing that kind of work. And I mean, I think, you know, there was some progress in the AIA in terms of, like, ethics, in terms of not building, you know, for example, solitary confinement facilities, because then you can lose your license. And I think that was, like, a really effective, that's an effective way of kind of going about things, because, like, yeah, you should lose your license for building detention centers. I think that is not what architecture is about, and it's completely unethical. But whether the kind of public pressure is still there to, or the internal pressure within architecture is still there, is a really, really uncertain question. And I'll do my part, but I can't, my eyes are peeled.
Zach, you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I mean, I think these sorts of facilities, especially if you're talking about kind of ad hoc, on the fly, need it yesterday, a place to stash, you know, 100 desperately poor Guatemalan folks who are just apprehended coming across the border, these types of facilities can often be shoehorned without, like, quote unquote, architecture, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's one thing. I think this entire thing is going to be like a rush job. I don't. I think we would probably know if AECOM or other, like, big mega firms, organizations that are kind of closer to the kind of meaty self-mythologizing about what capital A architecture is. I think we would know if they're already on the hook to, like, plan this and roll this out. I think, yeah, you're going to see, like, a lot of, you know, unused waste processing plants for government warehouses kind of shoehorned into this type of thing, and like people kind of on the edges of the design economy will be involved in building these nightmares for people that should maybe have some sort of stake in American bounty, because often they're fleeing conditions that we created. So I think in a lot of ways, I think in the short term, at least, architecture will be able to kind of keep this thing at arm's length in ways they weren't able to do with like NEOM in Saudi Arabia, because it won't have the kind of like roll up and flash and bang and pop around it in quite the same way that it's the same. So I think it might be kind of harder to track down, harder to isolate malefactors, especially in the short term.
I mean, I kind of think that when it was discovered that AECOM was planning to do work in Gaza, that required journalism to uncover. That was not something that was like that they made apparent through any kind of press release or something. It was people digging through like the bottom barrel of architecture jobs on like, you know, whatever website it was that found out that they were sneaking around out there. And so I think that it's not, and I agree with you that like this is actually going to be more on the vernacular side of things, so to speak, that we're going to be dealing with, you know, like ad hoc is a really good word. But it wouldn't surprise me either, because I think that the general culture has been moving in that direction. If firms, and they're not going to be glamorous firms. They're not really going to be like capital A architecture firms. They're going to be like the kind of plumbers of architecture. It wouldn't surprise me if that we started seeing those names come up. But I think the thing is that like this kind of, there is a little bit of shame, I think, still, which is good. There should be shame. And it's like, I think that there should be the pressure to keep up the shame, because like once they start sneaking, like once, you know, because there's a lot of money to be made in these kinds of endeavors. And once people start sneaking around, you know, then it's like a sign that the shame is not there. It's like NEOM, for example, was kind of a different thing because that was a kind of playground of the rich. But the stuff in Gaza where it was found out that, you know, where an active genocide was taking place, when it was found out that AECOM was sneaking around there with Netanyahu, is like, okay. This is kind of more, I think, on the lines of like what we would possibly see. But I actually, you know, I think that you're right. Look at the sheer logistics infrastructure that we already have right now that is not very documented in the built environment studies, except for like maybe like a few academics. There's like a whole landscape of buildings that really are not discussed in the public eye, but play a huge part in public life. And like how those buildings will be used to other ends, I think is a really interesting question. But I also think it's a journalism question and less kind of an architecture question. And so as far as like internally to architecture, I think we have to kind of keep a certain kind of pressure up to be like, yeah, actually this is deplorable if you work on things like that. And criticism plays a role in that. But I think also, you know, from inside the workplace also.
Yeah. Journalism first, cyberbullying second. Criticism maybe third.
We'll maybe third. Yeah. That's good for us.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of criticism, Zach, I want to come back to your contribution to the Naira Roundup on Mogalopoulos, where you tied, I think, if I understood it correctly, because the Tartarian discourse eludes me to some extent there, but Tartaria is this...
I'll tell you more than you ever want to know.
Please, but for listeners, our subterranean center of the Earth civilization here, but it is this notion, the aesthetics of Tartaria harken back to this notion of like make Tartaria great again, that we have some, had this fallen off civilization. My favorite, I took my... my children and my girlfriend to Chicago over the holidays, and was explaining to my girlfriend that people thought the Harold Washington Library was some sort of vanished set of technologies from the 19th century, when in fact it was completed in 1991. But anyway, Zach, please unpack the Tartaria hypothesis of this cultural moment for us.
Okay. Diving in, putting on the Tartario biohazard mask, yeah, once more. So there is a theory in some of the livelier corners of the internet that all or essentially all pre-modern architecture is, the result of this hyper-advanced, technologically powerful empire that really spanned the entire globe. This is the idea that as recently maybe as 150, 200 years ago, a hyper-advanced empire centered in Central Asia, which is kind of generically known as Tartaria, they were kind of colonizing, moving all over the world, and transporting various tropes. You see, like we see, you know, ziggurats and pyramids on several continents. They were responsible for that. They're responsible for star forts, for example. Really anything pre-modern that has kind of this patina of age and history is the result of this Tartarian Empire. And so, like, for example, World's Fair sites are a really fantastic example of that. And those are extra suspicious because, and the story does sound crazy, these were like mini cities that they built, sometimes out of plaster, and then just like kind of tore them down. And people say, oh no, these places were documented and then torn down. You know, when these kind of post-apocalyptic denizens of this current fallen world came across, and we would set up shop, kind of sell some popcorn, put our little trinkets in there, and then bulldoze them and say, like, this was ours, but never to be seen anymore. And so this has inspired kind of a closing of the Venn diagram of the current political movement. Obviously, this idea that there was this past hyper-advanced empire, basically a post-scarcity society, where a utopia, kind of harkens back to Trump's idea of make America great again, right? Like make America Tartari again. Allegedly, kind of to listen to the MAGA political narrative, there was kind of this state of balance and equilibrium and plenty, where we were in control of our own lives, and that was taken away, and kind of the various kind of malefactors here are often kind of thrown in like culture war directions. That's, you kind of see some of that echoed in Tartaria too. But it's really just, you know, like a kind of concurrent conspiracy theory that says, you know, we can harken back to this ancient age if we, in Trump's case, I suppose, kind of reattach ourselves to the various traditional values and kind of various types of nativism. And there are kind of various things within Trump's personal biography that people latch on to. There's this really like goofy story that mentions his uncle who taught at MIT, who somehow got a hold of Nikola Tesla's contraptions. And this was like some of the last remaining actual like Tartarian, like uncut fish scale technology, like really big cathode rays and gold domes that like suck up sunlight and turn into energy. Yeah. You can get like hovercrafts. They're so into hovercrafts. Hovercrafts and giants, like a hovercraft that could you know, float a giant around. I don't know, you love it. The mind reels. But
so how do you think they're going to make this actionable, Zach? Is there going to be a Pizzagate moment here? Is like, are we going to see like a storming of a government facility?
I hope not. Yeah, but one thing Trump has mentioned in the run to the election was that he wants to do like a big state fair. I guess I don't know. As I grew up in Iowa. I went to the Iowa State Fair, the most state fair of all state fairs, where you can eat, you know, an ostrich leg that's been deep fried or something. I don't know. These are amazing accumulations of kind of Americana culture and amazing examples of how we kind of extract and redistribute the literal fat of the land. Very inspiring. So he was kind of puttering on about saying you want to do something like that, and people immediately jumped on it and said, what he's really talking about is doing another World's Fair, like a Tartarian World's Fair. His Secret Service handle was Mogul, and there's like kind of a lot of speculation in Tartaria where the extent to which the geographic center of Tartaria kind of overlap with Genghis Khan's Mongolia, right? That entire...
No, it can't be like a Genghis Khan...
You know, there are many, many Genghis Khan connections. So like casino mogul, you know, like side character in casino, Genghis Khan, all kind of part of the same continuum, I guess.
Please tell me there's like a Hungarian nationalist connection. Also.
I haven't seen that just yet. There are many species of nationalism. I guess like the bigger deal here, the kind of top line is that enough people are paying attention to Trump and Tartaria and this kind of reactionary nostalgia that anything he says or anything that anyone allied with his camp will say can be, you know, using the hive mind of the internet, can be cross-referenced and lined up, right?
Like QAnon.
Yeah. It's reached kind of that point of self-awareness where it can read any, you know, any set of tea leaves, any set of, you know, deer intestines thrown on the cave wall. You can get something out of it. And some people are kind of playing along more intentionally. Tucker Carlson has nodded in this direction. Joe Rogan and Aaron Rodgers, who I do know have read one of my clips now because they were looking at it on their screen while they're recording a podcast. They've kind of nodded this as well. So, I mean, this is basically what happens when the kind of already moving kind of aesthetic moralist reactionary drive to ascribe, I don't know, teenage birth rates and, you know, kids with autism and women with purple streaks in their hair to a lack of pediments and columns. That's kind of what you take that and you throw in the internet and a heightened political atmosphere, and then you get Tartaria. So
this is crazy.
I will let Dan field the serious questions about aesthetics, but like, you just totally underscored what I've always thought the Trump administration aesthetic would be, which is basically Bioshock Infinite for video gamers. That's... of like a crazy cult of the founding fathers and like, you know, incestuous leadership and all sorts of insane stuff. But thank you for confirming that, Zach. But
yeah,
but Dan, unpack this here. What, you know, you're the architecture establishment of the co-host here, so take a question.
Sure. I mean, I guess I'd like to know what we think that maybe the realistic implications might be for architecture that has actually been questioned in the wider spectrum than the conspiratorial corners of the internet. For example, the FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C., a brutalist wedge that a lot of people hate and resent as a symbol of its, you know, supposed corrupt and oppressive ways. And there's a big movement to try to move the FBI out into the suburbs, into a campus, in as much as there's a broader effort in the Trump administration to decamp a lot of institutions from Washington, D.C. into the hinterlands so that they can become more American, putting quotes around it. Do we see a realistic move toward that happening, and would it be replaced with something classical, or is it just more Trump, you know, bravado and vaporware?
That's a good question. I means something different in D.C. than it does in other places. D.C. has this Arts and Humanities Commission, which is another layer of relatively independent aesthetic review of the buildings that make up kind of the federal imperial core of the city. So there are some other kind of variables in there. And I mean, I don't know.
I kind of think that there's some elements of it that are like a response to the 2010s with like the protests and things like that. Any like kind of attempt to decentralize some of these institutions, like the NSA is already, for example, like way out in Virginia and, you know, very much like a kind of fortress that you can't get into. And it's kind of like unusual that the FBI building is in DC. And so it makes sense, like the whole security apparatus at this point is like already suburban. The FBI building is really like, as much as it is like an architectural hot topic, you know, with the brutalism and whatever, from the left and from the right, it is like the last part of that puzzle that is not like its own fortress out in like Langley, Virginia. And I think the other thing is that I kind of believe that Trump's attempt to do classicism through like, you know, the Fine Arts Commission and all these other institutions, you know, the Shubo fiasco and everything, didn't really pan out. Like, nothing really came to happen from that, in part because buildings take a really long time to get built. Like, it takes a long time to get a permit for something in D.C. because there are, like, a bajillion layers of, like, regulations outside of, like, design review or whatever. They have, like, the height, the zoning, the everything. And so, like, it actually just, like, had no impact because things take so long to build, which I think is, like, really funny. But at the same time, I don't think that I almost feel like this is like on the back burner for Trump at this point, the aesthetics question, because I feel like that was almost a different kind of culture war at that time. And that culture war has succeeded. That's actually my perspective, is that this shift about architecture has succeeded in a lot of ways. Like, I mean, the whole goal of that was to kind of like put you in a position where if you said that modern architecture was good or something like that, and people would be like, oh my God, you hate beauty or something like this. But really, they were just kind of equivocating traditional architecture with, like, basically white supremacy or, like, European white supremacy. And so if you said something, and they tried to make you look crazy, like, if you said that something to that effect, they would be like, oh, you hate beauty? You think beauty is racist? You know? And, you know, it just became, like, this whole kind of troll that we all, like, ended up ensnared in. And it kind of like has already worked in a way. And so I don't like they've succeeded in taking architecture and politicizing it in such a way that like there is what was not necessarily like a left-right divide on like what was essentially like a kind of like inert topic of the built environment, which was always charged in like some way, but not in this particular kind of way where it was like then you could like attach it to grievance politics. And it's permanently attached to grievance politics now. And so the question for us becomes like, what do we do about that? You know, because we were just like, the grievance politics are wrong. That, okay, yeah, it's racist. Yeah, it's this. But I kind of feel like I stepped in a quicksand, you know, because now it's like, we didn't just like immediately, this is grievance politics, you know. How could you have like separated this from grievance politics without stepping in it yourself? And now I feel like it's kind of inextricable, and it's like a really interesting problem to me. But I don't know. That's how I feel about that.
Well, I totally think you're right. But pulling the telescope back, then, so how do the two of you see this grievance politics applied to? Let's look at urban form in this. So as we're taping this, GOP senators, including Tommy Tuberville of Alabama, are basically laying out ultimatums that they're going to withhold disaster aid to the state of California unless conditions are met. For people who are looking for like the starting gun of the second American Civil War, this might be it. This is exactly the kind of constitutional crisis where you're basically denying states their own access to federal funds. But I'm curious your thoughts on what you think will happen. What are your general thoughts and trends on American urbanism and urban policy? Not just, you know, the fact that President Trump has nominated Texas legislator Scott Turner to run HUD, where I believe he has described, I'm quoting from ProPublica, that he has called government assistance for poor tenants as, quote unquote, one of the most destructive things for the family. So that's setting the tone there as well. But yeah, how do you think cities will be seen as if they weren't demonized enough the first time?
Zach, right? I'll let you take this one since you're the city lab guy.
Sure. Okay. I mean, I read the same ProPublica article, and it was really sort of, I mean, Ben Carson kind of operated in the same role, right? And I think historically, if you look at GOP administrations and their HUD picks, it ends up, the organization ends up doing less. And obviously, like HUD, like they control flows of money. Like they're not really building housing themselves much anymore. That's all been privatized, like going back to like Reagan or so. It's important to keep in mind. But really, like it's under GOP administrations very often, HUD is tasked with kind of flowing that public sector money out to like their own farm team of kind of private sector AAC. Industry folks, and there's, you know, usually like kind of less supervision and examination on how much impact in terms of social housing this is really making. I think, I don't know, I mean, I think the situation in Los Angeles is just, it's horrifying and fascinating because like we're seeing so many kind of affluent incumbent people losing their homes. And I mean, some of these people are going to have kind of reach and clout that, for example, the folks in New Orleans East didn't have with Hurricane Katrina when they were abandoned. So I think there's going to be pressure that Trump might have to act like he's interested in reacting to because of all his kind of like right populist leanings, right? To what extent is he going to say, like, I am going to bail out maybe not this donor base in Los Angeles, but, you know, if you know, there's a hurricane that nails Florida and Mar-a-Lago and his actual kind of donor base and social circle are impacted, there'll be pressure that he might have to feel like he has to respond to. And that's going to be that'll be really instructive if he, you know, gives LA nothing and then turns on the spigots on the other coast. A lot of really, really tough decisions. I hadn't thought about it in terms of the Second American Civil War, but that type of hyper-local geographic focus would really, really sharpen things. yeah, I'll leave it there for now.
Well, I bring it up before I get to Kate on the Second American Civil War part, not to be flippant about it, but, you know, what we saw during his first term, obviously, the protest, the George Floyd protest in Portland, where, you know, he was basically calling for protesters to be apprehended by federal agents, in some cases without due process. And Jason Tester, who's a former colleague of mine at the Institute for the Future, has just put out a website, we'll put it in the show notes, called Insurrection, where he basically uses doctored photography of real photos to basically imagine a scenario of an occupation of San Francisco by federal troops to basically carry out deportations and clamp down on protesters, including the detainment in camps of protesters. So we're already seeing some like dark theories about where this goes, but there's this broader hostility to cities. Like we see, I mean, massive cultural war and grievance against cities already. And I'm curious about how that might be ramped up, but Kate, thoughts on
that? I also think that we have to remember that like, this, it really appears to me with like the Doge thing and stuff like that, that this is going to just be an engine for graft.
At 100%, 100%.
I mean, whether it's disaster relief or anything like that, or like building like, I don't know, FBI New Schwanstein or whatever in Langley, Virginia, like they are going to be, there's going to just be like massive levels of graft by private industry. And you're already seeing this in, like, there's just a kind of breakdown in any kind of regulatory or any kind of regulatory structure. Like, if you look in L.A., like, there's the number of landlords, for example, who are just price gouging people displaced by fire, which is illegal, like, under the law. Like, it is actually literally illegal, and they do it anyways because they do it via these platforms such as Zillow, where it's, like, harder and harder to detect because there's just so many of them, and there's no enforcement for any of those laws. And so, like, even if, like, laws aren't in place that help protect people during emergencies, you're already going to see things like this kind of graft go basically unimpeded. And it's like, it's crazy. My mother called me the other day and she's like, they're taking all the money from North Carolina to give it to California. And then she's like upset about it. And it's just, it's one of those things where I'm just like, oh my God, like this is gonna be just the nastiest thing of all time. But yeah, that to me is another huge one. Is just like there's going to just be massive theft and graft all across the federal government, all across things like the GSA, for example, all across things like, you know, new developments. Sorry, my dog is really going crazy. You know, and I really, you know, landlord graft is another one. You don't have to remember, Trump is a real estate guy. He is a landlord. You think he's going to punish landlords who are price gouging in LA? I think we're really going to see more of the developer in chief than we did the last time. And I mean, like, developer. Yeah,
the landlords are going to get bailed out.
Not developer. Thumbs up.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like, the real tragedy here is that it's understandable for people in poorly governed reactionary states to be blaming other more affluent states that maybe just experienced a disaster, like California, because they're freaked out and they're seeing their standards of living decline. Some sympathy there, absolutely. But I mean, there's like a real crisis of like blue city and blue state governance as well, right? So it's when, you know, when you have a housing crisis in, well, literally any major city, but it's worse in New York or LA or the Bay, for example, to name a few. The suspicion is going to go both ways, and you're much more likely to light off a kind of reinforcing cycle.
I mean, also, like, the question of, like, the insurance industry, I think, is going to be a huge question in the coming years. Because, you know, a lot of these properties that have burned down, like, you know, I know it's like, maybe feels mean to say, but they shouldn't be rebuilt in the way that they were built. It's not, they're just going to burn down again. This is like a Sisyphean task here. And, you know, you have all kinds of people coming out of the woodwork about this. You know, there's, like, the kind of classical YIMBYs who are like, oh, my God, we need to just build, like, 5-over-1s everywhere. And then, you know, there are, like, people who are – it's just one of those things where I think that what do you do in this situation where there's, like, a massive loss of housing and you have to move lots and lots of people? And, you know, we're already kind of seeing what's happening with that. It is things like – rent gouging, right? It isn't things like building social housing. It isn't things like FEMA. We're going to just see, I think, a complete and total atavism that comes from the climate crisis. And if it happens to a city like LA, which is, you know, one of the foundational places of American culture, you know, where everyone's favorite celebrities live, what's going to happen, you know, it's actually quite scary to me.
Yeah. What happens when it happens to Milwaukee? Yeah. Yeah.
Or like also the insurance industry is like something that's really interesting because they actually do know the risks. Like their refusal to insure these properties is going to cause like a, this is going to cause like a massive actual crisis that is going to cause friction across, rare friction across the private sector and the public sector. Because like there's political pressure to just like give money to people to rebuild their houses in disaster zones because, you know, what have you. And but the insurance industry makes money off of like, you know, offshoring risk. They don't want to actually take on those risks. And so the question is going to be like, is the federal government going to take on that risk? And that could just turn into another just massive crisis, you know. I mean, Gavin Newsom, I think, is already like being like, okay, like we're just going to suspend environmental permitting so that we can just rebuild in these places. And I feel insane reading that. It's like, we need more environmental permitting than anything because this is just going to happen again. Are we really just going to build like platform framed houses with like asphalt shingle roofs again in the fire zone? I feel insane.
Yep. Yeah,
we'll wrap up in a few minutes here with predictions from each of you for a second term. But this is where I want to note for listeners that I am on record from 2017 that President Trump would die in his second term due to stress from a climate disaster financial crash for all of the reasons that Kate just outlined there. So that's definitely mine. But I want to pivot quickly to ask you both in terms of how we got here, in terms of how he won re-election, and your thoughts on how the ongoing housing crisis contributed to this of affordability, not just the current housing crisis, because where I sit here literally in Montreal in Canada, Justin Trudeau, his downfall can literally be traced almost in real time to when Pierre Poilievre, the leader of the Conservatives, managed to outflank him on housing affordability, and young Canadians turned on Trudeau in the much the same way that young Americans turned on the Biden-Harris administration. I'm curious much, are you subscribers to the housing theory of everything, and how much do you think that this foreclosure of possibility for young people might have led to this rightward shift in the States as well? Or call me a crank if you like, but it does, you know, how real is this vibe session, particularly among the young voters who pivoted so far to the right? Zach.
Yeah, that seems real to me. I mean, I think people of color, Latinx folks, African-American folks, they tend to be under more housing pressure than the median American, and they're shifting right too. I think Trump's appeal has always been like, if you think politics is a sick joke, like come watch the sickest show in town. It gets really sick. And unless you can put forward like a vision of the future that, you know, offers a place for everyone in it in a kind of safe, secure lifestyle that they can see a future within, you're just going to watch like the sick show on TV. And I think like the easiest, most effective way to box anyone out of an idea of a future is to say you cannot amass wealth in the way that your parents did, in the way that your grandparents did. The only way to consistently, predictably amass wealth within what remains of the American dream, is the only way to do it anymore. Is with this roulette machine where, you know, you plunk your money down for something for somewhere, and usually it goes up unless the economy blows up. If you can't do that, there's no vision of the future. Kamala Harris didn't really articulate one. It was a post-policy election. And here we are.
I just want to say that rents went up more than 20% under Biden. And there was no talk at all about housing from Kamala Harris at all. You know, even Biden, when he was like still running, talked about a rent cap, which, you know, that was probably going to be bullshit, but at least it was something. And there should be a rent cap because 25% is insane. Like the apartment that I live in I rent for $1,750 a month. And it's like the rent is going up to $2,300 a month next year. And it's all because of like a number of different factors. Like some of it is scarcity, but a lot of it is graft. You know, because actually, if you think about it, like, you know, my neighborhood added units. It's not scarcity. It's graft. And it's things like Zillow, and it's things like RealPage, and it's things like they can just get away with it. Everyone just like watches this happen. If you want to talk about housing theory of everything, and I feel it myself, I feel absolute and complete despair. If I can't exit the rental market, what am I going to do? And it's like, but the actual means by which one can exit the rental market are becoming more and more unsustainable. And so it's one of those things where it's just like, Jesus Christ, where am I going to live? And it's like, I feel this, you know, And so I can't imagine, like, you know, people who are in a much less fortunate situation than I am going through this. And there's just no vision at all on this. You can't just, like, use the same rhetoric all the time about, or, like, kind of wonk rhetoric that doesn't, like, actually, you know, if you're losing your home, you really just don't want to hear about, like, FAR. You know what I mean? I'm sorry, like, not to be, a shitty populist here, but it doesn't do much. And I just kind of feel like one of those things where it is a little bit of housing theory of everything, but it's also a cultural shift that has been made possible by the tech industry. Like, it's been made possible through, like, these radicalizing platforms. It's been made possible by the pandemic, which made everyone so isolated and disrupted social functions so much that people have become more extreme as a result because they never get out, you know. And it's because, and it's the other thing is that these whole things have created a surveillance state that really hurts young people. Young people don't go out anymore. They don't do crazy things anymore because the camera is always there. You know, virality is always there. They think only in terms of getting rich and getting famous, and they don't actually think in terms of getting art. Those are cultural shifts that don't have to do with housing. Those are cultural shifts that were made possible by the way the economy has been going and by the way the tech industry has been shaping creative work, or any kind of work, really. And so I really feel like it's bad all around, but it's bad for a multitude of different reasons, some of which are actually cultural, but of course informed by material conditions.
Yeah, it's bad if you were born after 1960.
That is so true, man.
Full stop.
I kind of like walk around Chicago and hate 20th century architecture because I'm like, wow, nothing will ever be like that again.
Well, I slightly disagree with Zach on this because given the, you know, the demographic bracketing, at least in exit polling, is that Gen Xers were the most fervent supporters of President Trump.
Oh my.
And to me, I read that as the last generation to pull up the ladder.
That's
particularly
true.
On housing. The last generation, before it becomes generational wealth from boomers trickling down, they are getting theirs and none of you get anything. And the Xers have curdled.
Look at Elon Musk, you know, or like that kind of generation of guy, you know, or like the kind of crusty San Francisco tech people who rose like in the 90s. I mean, it really is like the yuppies of the 90s are like basically some of the most evil people alive at this point. So I don't know.
All right, we're drifting far from urbanism here. Dan, any last questions before we shift to prediction round?
I mean, wow, we are boiling the ocean while it boils itself for real here. Yeah, I mean, I guess what I would like to know is, do we think that there's going to be any meaningful impact that mayors can make in this context? Because I think the rhetoric, if not rhetoric, or the through line has been, look, with the first Trump administration, you know, from a policy perspective, you know, it's hostile to cities, hostile to the environment, not going to get anything done, pulled out of the climate agreement. It's up to mayors. But now we see that mayors are under so much, you know, national and global political pressure. If you look what happened with Karen Bass, you know, in it being stuck in Ghana, you know, at the least opportune moment while Los Angeles was burning. Do mayors have a shot in this context? And if so, what is it to kind of steer the ship away from some of these hazards?
I can dive in here. I think mayors have a shot, but we're probably like a few election cycles out from a mayor that is most importantly backed by a actual working class coalition that can mobilize them to kind of inflict their will, the people's will, you could say, on the situation. I think in Chicago, we were excited. This kind of left popular front came together to elect Brandon Johnson, who has been a disappointment. He has absolutely been a disappointment. I mean, like, we're arguing over, like, how much public money do the Chicago Bears get to build, their latest kind of throne room. He behaves and reacts in some ways the average neoliberal mayor would not. You can kind of still see his connection to, I mean, he hasn't, the CTU, the most militant teachers union in the country, are negotiating a contract now, and he has not completely equivocated to establishment interests and backed over them. So that's like maybe the most generous thing you could say at this point, but like, he is not fully like driven and informed by that base yet. So I think we're a few election cycles from a big city mayor who can kind of unite can unite labor, like the service, traditional labor, the service industry, young people, kind of various kind of racial intersectional formations that populate our cities at higher rates than maybe in rural areas. We're kind of still waiting to see someone that can reach into that and be driven by them, quite frankly. So, I mean, like everything else, it's an organizing issue. Good kind of mayoral governance is going to come from the ground up. And yeah, it's going to happen in a big major American city before it happens at the state or federal level.
Okay, so now we're going moving on.
Let's do a prediction round. All right, I already got one. I'll come up with another, but Zach just spoke. So, Kate, you both have been slightly warned. What's your prediction? Best, worst case scenario, or anything in between?
I really think that like I said before, I really think it's going to be just like graft all the way down. I think it's just going to be like robbing from the public coffers, and I think it's going to create like a breakdown in the rule of law, and I think it's going to create like a politicized situation that is going to really escalate in what are probably going to be violent ways. Whether like explicitly violent, I'm not sure, but like in terms of like violence against like minorities and violence against, you know, I mean, anything for, I would argue that like raising the rents during a crisis caused by climate change is violence. So I think we're going to see more of that. I think it's going to be complete atavism, every man for himself. And I also think that the only way out of this is if we start rebuilding the momentum of like the left and the momentum of like all of these movements that were ascendant during the 2010s, like that has to come back, or else we're not going to make it. That's my prediction.
Well, I'll follow up with you. A second prediction there. Do you think that we'll see a I was going to say resurgence, but we've never had a full surgence of mutual aid and other networks. What is there a built form social network organizational outcome?
I'm not
that'll
sure.
Happen?
I mean, you we see, have like, to do mutual it. Mutual aid it organizations like? In LA getting beaten by the cops, like people handing out food, people handing out, you know, toiletries, people like trying to help. They get arrested by the cops, which is where all the money from cities go. And until that money is reallocated away from police and more towards public services, that is how it's going to go. You can do that stuff, but you do it now with a kind of risk that is also scary. And so I think that the only way out of this is like mass political organizing, building mass movements. And like in the labor movement, obviously, but also just like building mass political organizations. And also we need to move away from the Democratic Party. I think that the failure of Kamala Harris is not only deeply embarrassing, I also think it's indicative that graft works in both parties. This was a slush fund for the consultant class, essentially. And so I think that, yeah, we actually, like, you know, we actually do have to move away from this party. We need a party for working class people, a labor party, perhaps. But we need to find some way to get out of this cycle, because the Democrats have lost to Trump twice. And the campaign Kamala ran started out interesting with the kind of the weird stuff that they were talking about. And then they immediately were like, we need to talk to Liz Cheney. And that's when, you know, it was kind of over. And it doesn't seem like anyone is really willing to change from the inside. And so you're starting to see outsider candidates run again, like in New York, for example, for, you know, the mayor's race, Zoran. And so I think that you're already seeing the stirrings of what was starting to happen 10 years ago. Whether it has the momentum, like, I don't know, but we need to find a way out of certain institutions, and we need to find a way that is different, because we failed. That is the truth. We failed the last time. Two times we failed, and not just in elections. We failed to stop the things that we're building that have created an existential crisis. And now we are on our feet, our back feet, reacting when we should have been on our front feet, preventing. And so that's how I feel about that. I know it's controversial, but that is how I personally feel.
I mean, the thing I always feel comfortable saying is it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah.
That's a general purpose prediction, along with Old People in Cities Frightened of the Skies, which is my favorite one by Bruce Sterling.
My parents, like every time before they come to Chicago, they're like the migrants. And I'm like, Mommy, Chicago is not on fire. Where are you getting this idea that Chicago is on fire? And then we have to go downtown. We have to take pictures of Chicago not on fire.
Yeah, the migrants are at my daughter's school learning English and learning how to read. And it's dope.
Well,
I love it.
Zach, I'll push you more on this one in terms of prediction. What do you think, and we might come to this, what would be a lasting built environment legacy of the second Trump administration, whether something he builds or something his people destroy? Like, what do you think, or an aesthetic shift, or what do you think we'll think about the Trump years, the second Trump reign?
This is like an outsider chance, but like, I mean, informal settlements, man.
Hoover
like bills. Shanty towns, like who?
Hoovervilles,
exactly.
Trump
I mean, there is precedence for it, and it's like you can. Imagine like the poetic vision of like you know these modernist former modernist mansions in the Hollywood Hills. They're like you know like. Imagine just like stacks of aluminum and wood pallets, you know, where Neutra and Schindler were hanging out. That would be the result of, you know, kind of certain sets of landlords not getting bailed out, and you know, certain cities very specifically being targeted and isolated to make this like unlivable. And it's like who, and then you have to ask the question of like who moves in. Is that where the migrants live? What's their relationship with you know the police and the liberal Gavin Newsom regime? It can get pretty dystopian. Watch for people collecting chunks of aluminum.
Yeah.
And
also, Hoover, famous trad guy.
Yeah,
there's actually quite a lot of similarities between Trump and Hoover, I think.
Dan, what's your prediction?
My prediction. I think it's safe to go with Zach's general interpretation. Yes, probably worse before it gets better. I actually draw from both of the prognostications that we've heard today, which is generally, I think we're going to see a lot of graft, and we're going to see a lot of really bad decisions made, and a lot of improvised, half-assed decisions made by whoever's in power, both at the national and the local levels. And I'm dismayed by that because there were a lot of things that were pointing in the right direction, but. Yeah, I feel like we're going to see the California high-speed rail line filled up with silt and possibly some temporary settlements if they finish the concrete work for that, which makes me very sad as a train person. But yeah, I'm not looking forward to it. It's with gritted teeth. My only hope is that, you know, it is only a four-year administration and it doesn't become lengthened due to national emergency, putting quotes in the air.
Well, that comes back to mind. So I'll reiterate my prediction that President Trump will die in his second term in office due to stress from a financial disaster.
No, but then we have Vice President Biden.
Well, you will have that problem. But the second prediction I want to give, since I owe a fresh one, and Zach raised it with Hoovervilles, I think is a great one. In the great book Storming the Wall about the militarization of borders in the face of climate migrants is in the 1930s, the state of Colorado set up checkpoints on the state border to keep out Okies. So I will predict that as a consequence is that we will see the reemergence of internal checkpoints and borders inside the United States as part of an ongoing fracturing. And so perhaps next time around when President Vance is elected in 2028, we'll discuss, should architects not build the internal checkpoints as the states break apart? But let's hope it doesn't come to that.
If you're talking about like a kind of you know, crisis that is in part economic and in part like this kind of crisis that is falling along ethnic lines, I think we are in some way seeing the disintegration of the American project. It's going to be very hard to resist the impulse to be kind of like, I got mine, rip the ladder up, like kind of run away with what you got. And I don't know. But I think most of the time, like, this is just my mildest prediction is that there's just going to be a lot of assholes stealing from the federal government in any way that they can. And just like firing public employees for their political views, basically doing this is the final phase of a project of politicization that the right has been waging since forever, since the 80s at least, where it's like, yeah, actually it has become like there is a precedent, or the goal is to establish precedents that allow like further erosion of democratic norms, like the Supreme Court being essentially like completely corrupt. Everyone knows it's corrupt. There's nothing anyone can do about it. The only thing someone could do is pack the courts via like some kind of executive order or what have you. There was like all this discussion about this thing that was not going to happen because the graft suits, you know, both parties, because both parties are run by the capitalist class. So that's the, one of those things where you're just going to see these slow, and I think actually not quite so slow, actually quite fast eradication of norms against like politicizing what are supposed to be like inert positions. Like, you know, just civil servant work, like what my dad did. He was worked for the General Services Administration. You know, they're just firing, like, civil servants for being, like, liberals or whatever, which is crazy. Like, that's kind of the goal of some of these things, like DOGA, for example. It's like, that's part of their purge. It's not actually about, like, you know, cutting government spending. It's about graft. That's the word of the administration, I think. It's just going to be, they're just going to rob Peter to pay Paul.
Department of Graft Enhancement. Trump towns. Well, if we have two words that come out of this,
there you go. Yeah. Well, I would say again, I agree. And before we adjourn, point out Brad Hargreaves, who writes the newsletter Thesis Driven, put out a recent newsletter on basically how the Supreme Court could remake the built environment with overturning of vital cases, including the bedrock of rent control, the Penn Penn Railroad, the Penn Central case about Grand Central, that in terms of basically eminent domain and government ability to take real estate. It'll be very interesting to see if some of this is relaxed and how that plays back into the graft as well, potentially. So, with that, I believe we're out of time. Kate, Zach, I want to thank you both for joining us for this. And certainly enlightening. I don't know if it was uplifting hour, but I would say I think looking at the future with clarity is an underrated skill these days, and the two of you look at it unflinchingly. So thank you for joining.
Clear eyes, full heart, can't cry.
So true. We laugh. I laugh so as not to cry.
Same here. As they said in Jurassic Park, hold on to your butts.
That was a good impression.
I do those. For money.